Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
What's up, everyone, and welcome back to the Master the Start podcast, the new and improved long-form version that we're trying for the first time this week. This week, we have an awesome guest. Howard Rutt is on the show. Before we get started, though, we just want to personally apologize to you guys saying we had a few audio problems. So throughout the show, Howard's voice is a little quieter. We had to adjust that. In the middle of the show, we had an awkward pause because we had to check the mics because we were trying new mics this week. So we had a few problems. At the end of the show, we cut it off a little early. So sorry about that, but the podcast is still super awesome, so you should be super excited for this week. Let's get into it. Howard Rutt, this guy is incredible, super genuine. I loved interviewing him. He started his career as a corporate lawyer, but soon turned into an entrepreneur and never looked back. He founded the Minnesota medical device company Vascular Solutions in 1997 and continued to run it for 20 years, inventing and launching over 100 new cardiovascular devices and creating over 650 US jobs along the way. In February 2017, Howard sold Vascular Solutions to Teleflex for $1 billion. He has a huge motivation for his book, Cardiac Arrest. Sorry, I should probably give you the whole title, but his book is Cardiac Arrest, Five Heart-Stopping Years as a CEO on the Fed's Hit List. You can find it on Amazon, find it at Barnes & Noble, all those good places. But he has a real passion for his book because he actually sold Vascular Solutions because of a true life legal nightmare. It all started out as a false accusation by a disgruntled former employee and culminated into 5 years later in a San Antonio courtroom with a not guilty verdict on all charges after a 5-week criminal trial. Even a single guilty verdict would have excluded Vascular Solutions from selling any of its medical devices in the US and would have sent Howard to prison for years. This was a federal criminal prosecution over the words spoken by a few of the company's salespeople about an FDA-cleared medical device that constituted only 0.1% of the company's sales and never harmed a single patient, yet required a defense team of 121 lawyers at a cost of $25 million. So you're gonna hear Howard talk about this trial. He gives great advice about several other things, and I hope you enjoy this week's episode of Master the Start.
Thanks for coming. It's pretty sweet. I'm happy that you knew John.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby. I'm happy to do it. Listen to all your podcasts, and it's great stuff.
Well, the reason why I really reached out is because I was actually here with John a week ago or so, and he was talking about how you would be the perfect guy that could share a crazy experience that would blow our listeners' minds. So honestly, I think we should just start with the story, mainly because after reading your book, you're a great storyteller. I'll put it in the show notes. It's Cardiac Arrest. I always forget the last part because I always mess up exactly how you say it. Cardiac Arrest, Five Heart-Stopping Years on the Fed's Hit List. So everyone should check that out. I think it's an amazing read.
It's like the most demotivational story in America. So if you're listening to this, put away the knives. You know, don't have any broken glass edges around. Because everything you've done up to this point has been motivational, getting people to do more. And this is a cautionary tale of, you know, go out there and live your dreams. And when you do it, you could almost get thrown to prison for absolutely nothing.
So yes, that is for sure. So I think you need to tell everyone the story, just a quick rundown of it so everyone's up to date. And then I'll ask you a few questions off of that.
Okay, I'll condense it as much as I can and still get the gist of it. I'm sure I'll leave details out. So I started a medical device company called Vascular Solutions back in 1997. And I grew it for over 20 years. So I grew it from one medical device where I had a doctor had an idea. I started the company and got that on the market. We created a sales force. We went public. We were a public stock. We did pretty well. Then we didn't do so well. And then we started coming back in 2004. And by 2008, 2009, we were almost profitable. And then 2011 comes along and I get hit with something right out of the blue, which is I'm just sitting there in my office and a subpoena comes in, and the subpoena is the government's investigating me for a felony. And like, what? You know, I'm an Eagle Scouter, taught Sunday school, never done anything wrong. I was a lawyer by training. I taught my people to do the right thing. I'd never even get close to the edge. And what had happened was a disgruntled former employee, which we had 750 employees at that time, so you can imagine there's at least a couple that are disgruntled, created a complete fable of all this activity that got into the company and sold that to a U.S. attorney down in San Antonio in order to try to get money, because whistleblowers can get money from the government if they pitch them a story and the government shakes money out of the business. The whistleblower will get 25% of the recovery for doing absolutely nothing except creating a story that the prosecutors take off on and the company pays money. Well, you know, it was an insignificant product, made up 0.1% of our sales. It never harmed a patient. It had been FDA cleared 8 separate times. And this whole allegation was whether the salesperson had said the word perforator instead of saphenous when talking about a treatment for varicose veins. Just completely ridiculous stuff, right? So you think it's going to go away. And lo and behold, this snowballed over 5 years to where 5 years later, I'm down in a San Antonio courtroom in a felony trial where if I lose, I'll go to prison for over 3 years. I spent $25 million, hired over 120 lawyers, and 5 years of pain and suffering dealing with prosecutors who wanted to put me in prison over absolutely nothing. And, you know, you get into that, and there's days you wake up, you go, how did this happen? Where isn't there some way to stop this runaway train? And the answer was there wasn't, until we got to the trial. And then we get to the trial and the prosecutors get up and their witnesses contradict their whole theory, because the theory's wrong. They just blow apart their own case when they call their witnesses. Their own witnesses admit we did not commit a crime. Gets to our chance. We don't have to call any witnesses because we already won. We give it to the jury. Jury comes back not guilty on all counts. Go back home. It's like, great, great. But what about the people who don't have $25 million? What about the people who aren't trained in the law so they can't get the right legal team? You know, what could happen to other people that could go through this? That's a real problem. That's why I wrote the book, partly to get it off my chest, but also partly to show people that this can happen to you, and if it does, you need to be ready for it. Now, when I got back, then I decided to do the only sane thing that there is to do after you go through that experience, sold the business, because I wasn't going to give this government a second chance. And when you go out there and start talking about what's really going on in the prosecutor's offices across this country, attacking businesses who do no harm, they're going to come after you if they can. So I sold Vascular Solutions, sold it for $1 billion. It was a great success story. Retired from that, and I'm off doing electric-powered pontoon boats. If you can imagine that, that's my next venture. Because I want to do something fun. My wife doesn't want me home all day long, and I got to do something. And that's far removed from medical devices, much less regulated, not a DOJ issue at all. And I'm having fun doing that.
So I have to ask, like, based off of you really selling the company after the whole situation, was it a fear that made you sell it, or was it just you lose the passion after that?
Well, here's what it is, to be honest with you, is when I came back, I realized that I'd been hardened by this. Anyone would be. I mean, seriously, you're sitting there in a trial with all these people trying to put you in prison, and you're thinking, if a salesperson says the wrong word, I could go through this again. And you come back and you go, what am I going to do to avoid that? How am I going to prevent that? The only way you could is by being the biggest SOB in business. You just pound the crap out of them. They say one wrong word, they're gone. And I didn't want to be that boss. I didn't want to be the guy who's got to be so just hardened and skeptical. I'm 57. You know, you're the oldest young guy in America. I listened to your podcast last time. You're giving advice that I would give. I'm 30 years older than you, and you're parroting my words here, Bobby. I mean, it's great stuff. But not only was I old by that time, but I also was jaded. And nobody likes a jaded CEO. You can't be inspirational. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just retire and turn it over to the next guy. The next guy would have destroyed the company. So the better thing to do for the shareholders and the employees who were there was to sell it. At least they'd get their money out and everyone would be happy with that. The company's not going to be the same. It's not the same. The new owners are dismantling it fairly quickly. But that's what happens when a big company acquires an entrepreneurial company, 9 times out of 10 at least. So that was the ultimate result, but I wasn't going to be able to run it the way I wanted to run it after I went through that experience.
Okay, this is off script now because I'm just curious about you spend 20 years building a company. It's your baby, right? And I can imagine this. It's your little baby that you're trying to protect. How do you feel now that you actually sold it and now it's being dismantled?
Yeah, you know, I'm a guy who lives in the moment. And I think you've talked about this with some of your other guests.
Yeah.
You got to live in the moment with your business. What's your successes? My success wasn't selling it. My success wasn't building it. My success was when I could have a medical device that a doctor used and it did a really good job and they asked who invented it and I could say, I did. I mean, I'm a lawyer and after working in there for 15, 20 years, I was inventing medical devices. That was super cool for me. That was so much fun. But that's a moment. And the next moment, you're onto something else, you're doing something else, and you can do that multiple times, but everything you build in this world will eventually go away. And it's only a question of when and how. And if you go out on your own terms, when you sell it, you claim victory, you have the party, that's as good as it gets. If you keep doing it and it gets destroyed, or if you lose the edge, or you become an ogre, then it's not your terms, and then it's not a success. So everything has a life. The important thing is to realize when it's being born, how you build it, and then when to get out, because no one can last forever, and then be happy with what you did as opposed to looking back. And then the other thing is the one way to be a 100% purely successful entrepreneur is to do it well once and never do it again. Because if you do it a second time, the odds are just as bad that you're going to fail. I mean, you had to have a lot of luck to be that successful. If you do it again, you probably won't have that luck and you won't be successful. So doing it once, calling it quits, I'm the 100% purely successful entrepreneur.
That's so true. That's so true. Well, then I thought it was really interesting in your book. You talk about going from law to CEO of a medical device company and how that's quite a transformation. So, I mean, we have a lot of young professionals listening to this.
Right.
So what advice do you have for young professionals that are actually exploring a career and maybe not being satisfied in that career, wanting to explore something else, but being so afraid of that outside noise? You know, your parents want this, your friends expect that. How do you get over that outside noise and really pursue that thing you want to try?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, in college, I took 3 science classes, one of which was astronomy. And there I am in my 40s inventing medical devices and working with physicians and telling our sales force how to use a medical device on heart attack patients. Very bizarre. But the thing I did in high school and college, and this was just my angle, everyone's got to have their own, I was a debater. And in debate, you learn how to learn. You dig deeply into things that you know nothing about. You learn everything about it, and then you got to argue with someone else about it. And a judge tells you at the end of the round, you're bad. You got to get better. And it just hits you, and you go back, and you work your butt off. And that's the most important thing in college or in the early part of your life, is learning how to learn. Because I went from a debater to a lawyer, and law school taught me a lot how to delve into issues and learn things. And then I worked for a medical device entrepreneur for 6 years, and I learned everything I could. In fact, I was single at the time. I met up a nurse at a bar who was working at a hospital. I wanted to go in and see an open-heart surgery, so I sucked up to her. I didn't want to go to her place that night. What I wanted to do was invite me to her work the next week so I could be there when a doctor does a procedure. And she does and brings me in. And I'm sitting there while Dr. Nikoloff down at Abbott Hospital is doing a triple valve redo. It was just so wonderful. That was great, great stuff. But I had to find an angle so I could learn. Now, the other thing, you have to be realistic of who you are and what your strengths are. I'm never going to be a race car driver or a basketball player. But there are other people who won't be able to be an entrepreneur, because it does take talent. I want to just be brutally honest. If you don't have that ability to quickly master things and to communicate things and get to the point and get your work done, it's a bad job to become the leader of an organization, because you will fail at it. So you got to be balanced there. One is you got to do something that you're good at. Then you got to learn how to learn. And then the last thing, which was your point, you got to shut out the naysayers. I don't know how many times people said, you can't do that. I mean, people even in the industry said, Howard, you can't do that. You're just a lawyer. I mean, as if a lawyer was a wrong term. Because I was a lawyer, I couldn't learn anything else. But people get it all the time. I mean, they say, well, you're a woman, you can't do this. Or you're a young kid, you can't do this. But it's actually, you're a lawyer, you can't work with doctors. It's ridiculous. But if you let that affect you, you will let it win. So the important thing is to find something you're good at, give it your passion, give it your drive, and then shut out everything else until you see that can get done. Hopefully you succeed.
Fair enough. Fair enough, yeah. For sure. Well, then you had to have gone through legitimately 5 of the most stressful years any of us will probably ever endure. So right. I have to ask, number one, how do you deal with just the normal day-to-day life with that kind of stress for 5 years. Number two, for all of our young professionals out there that deal with just little stressors in life, do you have any recommendations on how you handle those little stressors?
Yeah, it was a stressful time. So I'm running a public company, so I'm still running it. I've got the front page lead story of the Star Tribune saying, MedTech CEO accused of fraud. I've got everyone who's ever known me. I grew up in St. Anthony Village, went to the University of Minnesota. I'm a lifetime Minnesota resident. Everyone who's known me, and us Minnesotans, we never move away. We always stay here, right? And we harbor grudges against everyone you met since grade school, right? So I know there's lots of people out there saying, ah, Howard, I always knew he was a little sinister. It was always, you know, you're thinking that kind of stuff, but you still got to run this company. To me, that was the saving grace. Because every time I'd wake up and I'd say, oh my God, what am I going to do? I got to fire my lawyer. I got to get a new lawyer because this guy's not doing it right. My second lawyer, the one that I had to fire, he actually told my board of directors that if Howard pleads guilty, we'll be able to keep him out of prison. That was his defense strategy. You know, if that guy's going to bat for you, you need him off the team. You need someone else. And I got to go tell my board that I need to hire a new lawyer. I mean, this is stuff that normal people don't have to go through. So when you get up and you realize that and you're understanding that this doesn't have a guaranteed chance of success, what keeps you sane is being able to do something else that's productive during the day. So I came into the office and I worked on the medical devices. I came in and I interacted with the salespeople, not on the legal case, but on our products. I had our operations meeting. I let my mind be busy with the stuff I needed to get done, so I wouldn't let it wander to the things that I couldn't do anything about. Don't worry about things you can't control. Worry about the things you need to get done to improve your odds of success. Easier said than done. I counsel people now going through the same thing that I've gone through, and I see it in their faces. They don't have anything to do. Their job is on hold. They've been put on hiatus while this criminal prosecution's gone forward. And they know that they're going to win, but for the next 2 years, they've got nothing to do, and it eats at them. So the important thing is to be productive in your life and don't let the stuff you can't control consume you, which, again, you know, I'm a poster child for that because this would have been something that could have really taken me down.
So how did you handle it in year one? When you compare year one to year five, how much did you grow in those 5 years when it comes to handling stress? What did you do in year one that was different than what you did in year five?
Well, year one, I thought this was a ridiculous, stupid thing. In year one, I thought, here's how stupid I was. I'm a lawyer, remind you. You know, I got the subpoena, and they started calling my employees down to San Antonio to interrogate them. And they'd come back looking ashen because these prosecutors were pounding the crap out of these people, wanting them to say that the company was engaged in criminal behavior. So the prosecutors would tell the employee, you got two choices. Either you admit that the company is engaged in criminal behavior, or you're going to be the target of this. Now, if you admit it, we'll give you immunity. And when we settle with the company, your job will be safe. But if you deny it, we're going to destroy you along with the company, and we'll prosecute you for perjury if we think you've been lying. Well, I mean, these people don't know what to do. And, you know, you talk about false confessions, you talk about making a murderer, all these things that they do with, you know, poor little Bobby Dassey and all these, or not Bobby Dassey, he's the other brother, but Brennan Dassey. All these things they've done in those cases, they also do to business people. And all of a sudden, it awakens you. So at the beginning, I thought, all I have to do is sit down with these guys and talk with them. If I can sit down with the prosecutor and talk with them, I'll get it taken care of. If I had done that, they would have prosecuted me for perjury. They would have found something I said that they didn't agree with. They would have indicted me on something else. That would have been a harder charge to beat than the nonsense they went after. At the beginning, I thought someone from the Department of Justice will get involved. I thought maybe Amy Klobuchar, who I knew from my legal days, would call the Department of Justice and say, find someone to take a look at this. None of that happened. So at the beginning, I wasn't consumed with it because I thought it would go away. In the middle, when I realized that I had a bad legal team that had to change, that I had prosecutors who were out of control, I had no one who's going to go to bat for me, that's when it started getting really bad. But then at the end, it got better because we were down in San Antonio just laughing out loud at the prosecutors. They were the worst lawyers in a courtroom I've ever seen. The two of them, two guys who prosecuted me, combined, had done two trials in the last 10 years. I've been in more trials on the civil side than they had, and they're the prosecutors. One guy turns to the other guy and says, you know, Bud, permission to approach the witness? And Bud says, Tim, in the courtroom, we asked the judge that question. It was like an Abbott and Costello routine. The closing argument was was like a beat poet, kind of neat scat poetry. It was bizarre. And I put it in the book because no one will believe it unless you read it. You almost have to read it out loud to understand how crazy this was. So there was that confidence as well as how bad they were that was fine. But I don't want to belittle. In the middle, it was bad. It was really bad to try to think about how we were going to juggle all these balls at the same time.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend anyone listening, like I said, you need to read the book because I read it this week, and I already told Howard this. I legitimately laughed out loud enough listening or reading the trial that someone asked me to go in a different room because I couldn't help myself. It was just, it was so darn funny.
Well, and there's a good lesson in the book, too. I have a co-author, Stephen Saltarelli. And he was a young lawyer on the case and then gave up the practice of law to be a screenwriter out in L.A. after the case was over. So I hired him to work with me on this. And you read, he has one chapter in there, what it's like to be a sleep-deprived associate on a criminal trial. Hilarious chapter for certain people. Other people don't like it, but it's an acquired taste.
It is hilarious.
But, he added a lot of spice into the book and the way that we structured it together. I mean, the idea is the short chapters with a kind of a screenplay kind of feel with a lot of building momentum, that kind of stuff. The lesson here in business is he did something that I couldn't do. I'm a real factual writer. I'm a storyteller. I think I'm a good writer, but I'm not a creative writer. And he's a creative writer. So I would write everything down, and then he would take it and edit it. And by edit it, I mean rewrite it. And then I'd rewrite that. And between the two of us, we came up with something that's so much better than he could have done alone, or certainly that I could have done alone. And so in business, when you're hiring people, they always say, hire people that are better than you. I look at it differently. Hire people with strengths that are your weaknesses. If you look at who you need to add to a team when you're getting started, figure out what you can't do and find someone who can do that very well. You don't need to have two people who do the same thing great. It's wonderful if you can. At the beginning, you have to have someone who can cover all the bases. It's the same thing in writing a book as it is in running a company.
So during the 5 years, and when you always talk about your board, you talk about executives in the company, could you guys have open communication about what was going on, or were you supposed to be quiet?
Well, that's a great question, Bobby. I mean, it gets into the details of it. The lawyers, so there's so many lawyers involved. Why over 100 lawyers? I didn't fire 99 and end on the last one, right? There's so many lawyers because everyone has to be represented, and everyone has to be represented independently. So I was a defendant. I had my lawyers. The company was a defendant, had his lawyers. One of our sales reps got indicted for perjury. For a nonsense claim, he had his lawyers. The employees who were brought down to San Antonio had a pool counsel. If they weren't yet charged, they could be represented by one lawyer, that lawyer. And each of those lawyers had local counsel in San Antonio. We employed virtually the entire San Antonio legal profession being our local counsel. But then, so you've got different lawyers representing different groups. And so my vice president of marketing is advised by her lawyer, don't talk to Howard while this case is pending. Now, this is going to go on for like two more years. The vice president of marketing is not supposed to talk to the CEO, not just about the case, about anything. Just don't talk to him. It was ridiculous because the lawyer didn't understand business. And that wasn't a requirement. That's just his, let's make sure we play it safe. Well, the safe ship sailed many years ago. Now we're in the middle of a war. We've got to keep the company together. I told the lawyers, if we win this trial and I come back and all that's left is a building that says Vascular Solutions at the top, we've lost. We have to both defend the company and save the company. Defend it in court and save it in the business world. And that's the hardest thing for them to understand. So I had to manage my lawyers to make sure that they weren't telling me things that would destroy my company in the name of saving it. So what you can't do, and this is where my legal background was really beneficial, because I could understand what the legal concepts were. I wasn't a criminal defense lawyer, but I could learn that pretty darn quick. Being a defendant for 5 years, I think I am a criminal defense lawyer now. There were things I couldn't talk about. I couldn't try to pump the witnesses for information. I couldn't give them the facts that they were supposed to communicate to the prosecutors. We didn't talk about that. But I could talk to them about, do you have a lawyer? Are you happy with your lawyer? Do you want to have another lawyer? Because that doesn't get to the facts of the case. Certainly could talk to them about business. And then if they had a question, I could refer them to the lawyer to get the question answered. I could tell them to have their lawyer talk to my lawyer. We could work it that way as well. But you've got to coordinate a defense like this because the government has incredible power and they can destroy virtually anyone. The only people who are able to make it out sane and whole are people like me who have the money and have that legal background. And so if you've got that advantage, you got to use it because otherwise you'll get rolled.
So I have to ask, did you get any of that $25 million back?
Not a dime. No. Foolish question, Bobby. Foolish question.
Well, does anyone get their money back when they go to trial?
There is a statute. It's called the Hyde Amendment by Henry Hyde. There's a Hyde Amendment that's an abortion thing. That's not it. This is about wrongfully accused criminal defendants. And it says that if you've been the subject of a false, malicious, and there's one other word, a bad word in there, prosecution, one of the three, that you can get your attorney's fees back from the government. Right. You only have to have one of the three. It was false. It was malicious. It was the other one as well. We had it proven in spades. But there's an exception. The exception is if you are worth more than, I think it's $1 million, you can't take advantage of the statute. Or if you're a corporation with a net worth over $5 million, you can't take advantage of the statute. Because back in the 70s when it was created, that was considered to be the rich people, right? Today, you realize this is the perfect catch-22. The only people who can survive a malicious prosecution have more than $1 million. And so the only people who can survive it are the ones who can't get their money back at the end. The people who don't have $1 million will be destroyed. And once you're destroyed, you can't then prove it's malicious because you pled guilty or you're found guilty. So nobody ever takes advantage of the Hyde Amendment. Nobody can do it. Beyond that, it gets even worse. You think these prosecutors did really bad things to my employees. They took grand jury transcripts from one witness and read it to another witness and said, your testimony has to be the same as this or I will prosecute you for perjury. Now that's obstruction of justice because you can't read secret grand jury transcripts to another witness. And it's obstruction of justice because you're trying to impermissibly change the truthful testimony of a witness. Now we thought, well, we get these prosecutors in trouble. Prosecutors have absolute immunity. Anything they do, even if it's criminal, they cannot be prosecuted for. They are the ones who have the most power of anyone in America today are prosecutors because they can't be prosecuted. Well, you think, well, there must be some misconduct thing you could do. You can make an allegation of prosecutorial misconduct. We've done that. It goes into the Office of Professional Responsibility, which reports to the Department of Justice, and it's staffed by career prosecutors. So we said these guys did things that are clearly misconduct, and my lawyer legal team included the former head of the criminal division of DOJ. So these people are in D.C. across the street from the White House, very high-profile people. They said this is serious misconduct, should be investigated, shot down. Not even with an investigation, not even asking a question, no interviews at all. They said this is not likely to lead to any action taken against the prosecutors, therefore we will not do any inquiry. So if you think, if you get involved in a prosecution, if you think that there are people who can prosecute the prosecutors, or can regulate the prosecutors, who oversee the prosecutors, you are sadly mistaken. And the number one lesson is, I want to make sure I get this out before I get onto another tangent. The number one lesson for everyone who listens to this podcast, an absolute rule, is if a prosecutor or an investigator shows up at your office or your door and wants to ask questions, you say politely, I'm sorry, I have to speak with my lawyer. You don't say, I'm not going to say anything. You don't take your Fifth Amendment rights. You take your Fourth Amendment rights, which is right to assistance by counsel. Everyone who gets in trouble in these cases is not represented at the critical time, and that's at the very beginning. And you may think, I didn't do anything wrong, so therefore I'm going to cooperate. That's the worst thing you can do. If you didn't do anything wrong, that's when you exactly should not cooperate with the investigation and answer any question, because then they may think that you are the one they're going to go after. Numerous cases where people spoke to law enforcement officers about something and got prosecuted not for what they did, but for what they said.
Jeez, it's painful to listen to, only because someone like me, or a young professional, millennial, whatever we call ourselves, or probably anyone in the world, likes to imagine that this can't happen. Like, we all like to imagine that isn't even a possibility in this country, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. But I hope no one has to ever go through it again, by all means. But what do you think, what structures do you think you had in place in your company that allowed you to really prove your innocence, made you prepared for that? Because I know you brought up, like, you had all your documents for meetings, sales reports, had everything. It sounded like you had everything pretty organized. Like,
right.
What do you recommend for anyone starting a company, working in a company? How do you make sure everything's done right in a way that if this happens, you're all buttoned up?
Right. So you're absolutely right. This is one thing that people can't believe happens. And when I give my talk, and I've given my talk 85 times about this case around the country in the last year and a half, one, because I like doing it, but it's kind of like Groundhog Day now. And I keep trying to twist the presentation so I can get past that obstacle, because everyone comes in thinking this can't happen in America. I had one investor who I sat down with when the case was going on, and I explained a little bit as I could at the time what was going on. And he looked at me and said, I've seen this happen before, because I was born in Latin America. You know, he was born down in Colombia. And in Colombia, this goes on all the time, but no one believes it happens here. So I started with a slide in my presentation often that says, it is now life and not art that requires the willing suspension of disbelief. People listen to this and they hear my case and they think, well, it won't happen to me. Or they think, Howard must be leaving something out. There must have been something he did that caused this to happen. Prosecutors wouldn't do this. They're not greedy. They're not getting paid for this. Oh, prosecutors are the greediest people I've ever met. I've met cardiologists, which, ask your dad, cardiologists have the largest ego in medicine. And I've dealt with hedge fund managers. And in the financial world, they are the largest egos there. I've never met anyone with egos as large as the prosecutors, but they were not greedy for money. They were greedy for a conviction. They wanted to see a CEO of a medical device company go to prison, because that's the way they advance their career. And greed for power, greed for fame, greed for advancement is every bit as powerful as greed for money. So what do people do? How do you prepare for this? Well, the first thing is, be the right person. Don't do things that are wrong. And I'll put the qualifier in here. There are criminals in business. There are people who deserve to go to prison. They are in prison now for a good reason. They did something wrong. Tom Petters, I will never give advice to. I don't want to see him. I've never seen him. I don't want to deal with him. I know enough about it. He was convicted. I believe he's wrong. Now, when people get alleged to have done something wrong, we are innocent until proven guilty. Live that out, because if you looked at the newspaper headlines 5 years ago, you'd think I was Tom Petters Jr. or something. That obviously is not true. But there are people who do commit crimes in business and they deserve to go in prison. So first thing is, do everything right. Second thing is, don't assume that just because you do everything right that you won't be attacked. Don't assume that. Make that false assumption. So people ask me, the worst question they ask me at the end of my presentation, it's one I get so upset about, and I should not, but I get upset, I try to cover it up, is they ask me, so looking back, what are the one or two things that you could have done then that would have prevented this whole thing? And I roll my eyes, just like you did, Bobby. I mean, I roll my eyes because it assumes a fact, not an evidence, as we say in law. It assumes something that's not true. It's assumed that I did something wrong, or if not that, it at least assumes that if you do everything right, this won't happen to you. It also assumes, from my perspective, that they're looking for one or two little simple little life lessons they can do that will avoid any chance of them getting involved in a prosecution run amok. And I'm saying, this is a lottery. We're all in it. We're all spinning the wheels. And sure, you don't have a one in two chance of winning this lottery, but if you're the CEO of a medical device company, you're probably a one in three chance of being a target of a criminal investigation. You know, that's pretty bad odds. If you're running a financial institution, maybe one in five. If you get down to where you're just Joe Schmo on the street, maybe one in a thousand. But you still got a chance. And if your number comes up, it's not good enough that you just didn't do it. It's got to be you're prepared for that if it happens. The number one thing you can be prepared for is know what to do. And that is, don't speak to the prosecutors. Don't speak to the police. And people say, well, God, I mean, I trust the police. The police are good people. Trust me. Police officers tell their children, don't talk to the police if you get pulled over. I mean, give them your license, your insurance. Say yes, sir, and no, sir. Be as polite as you can. Comply with their instructions. But don't talk. Don't give them information. Because as soon as you start doing that, it's open game. The Miranda rights are gone. Everything you say will be used against you, and they will make it as if you did something wrong. So that's the thing you can do. Then the third thing is, in business, document what you do as if it's a trial exhibit. And this is what we did. Is when we got to trial, we were prepared to put on the whole case. In fact, we cross-examined their witness with all of our documents, which just destroyed any implications that we were a bad organization. I gave the compliance message to my entire 100-person sales force. I told them, we do what the law requires and then some. I had this in PowerPoint slides, which is there ready to be presented at trial. So I could convince the jury that I was a guy who believed in doing the right thing. The number one thing for me, for one of the jurors, was I was an Eagle Scout. He was an Eagle Scout. He found out I was an Eagle Scout and he was an Eagle Scout. He wasn't going to convict me for anything. So good, clean living helps, finding out what you can do to present that, but having your ducks in a row in case you do get attacked is important. Having said that, you know, if you're starting up a business, you don't have time to sit there and write memos to yourself about what you did every day. You got to get your work done. So no matter what you do, you will be at risk. You won't be perfectly covered. Just realize this can happen. And if it does happen, don't speak to the investigators. That's the number one rule.
Okay. Now, this is a little more personal, I guess, in a sense. But I have to imagine, after you go through something like this, even though you found not guilty, I can tell just from sitting down with you, you're a heck of a guy. There has to be a lot of people that are constantly around you, still giving you that stare or looking at you like you for sure had to have done something wrong. You just got away with it. How do you, like, or even these talks. Like, yeah. You obviously have right. A lot of people that are very skeptical after. How do you deal with, really, I guess in our generation, we call them the haters. How do you deal with that? Do you have to be an egomaniac to deal with it? You have to be so fine with who you are. I just don't understand how you deal with it.
Well, this is why I love your podcast, because you ask the questions other people don't ask. You've got a mind that's going into details of stuff that's interesting, at least to me, and it appears it draws things out that are different. And now I just forgot what you asked, having said that. I was just in awe of your questions and thinking about other things you did on other podcasts, and I forgot what you asked.
Okay, what I asked was, you know, for any young professional, we always deal with haters in a sense, but you have to deal with them, I'm sure, every day.
Yeah. And so here's the interesting thing of this. I've given this talk 85 times, but it's a wide range of audiences. I've done everything from medical device CEOs and the compliance officers to chambers of commerce and rotary organizations and to women's clubs, you know, the Association of University Women, you know, from conservatives to liberals. It doesn't matter. The political spectrum, it doesn't care. This isn't an Obama DOJ against Howard Ruth thing. This is prosecutors against a business guy. And everyone is interested in that story. So it's so many different people in the audience. I get to judge their reaction. And I know my presentation so well, I can be paying attention to them rather than looking at the slide, right? The number one worst audience for me is medical device CEOs. They are the biggest haters, disbelievers of the entire audience system. The people who this applies to the most are the ones who pay attention the least. I've had a number of times where they pull out their iPhone in the middle. I mean, I hate doing it over lunch because usually if they haven't eaten, by the time I get to the third slide where they're threatening the children of my employees to say the wrong thing, all the silverware goes down and no one can eat, right? But medical device CEOs who should be scripting this down and trying to figure out what to learn from this are sitting there doing their little texting back and forth. And then at the end, they ask me for one or two little things that could make them not a target. And it's like, I'm trying to figure out why that's the case. And then they think that I must have done something. Well, here's what the trade association said about me after I got indicted. Howard has a loud voice. Not everyone loves that. But when we've asked him to offer his opinion to issues, he has spoken. And he has, something like that. That's what the Medical Device Trade Association, Life Science Alley, PR person, said about me that was quoted in the paper when I was indicted. That way to stick behind me, guys. Way to really be a supporter. Way to really circle the wagons around me. They've known me for years. And afterwards, not an apology from that guy, nothing. Nobody thinks that's a problem. Well, there are haters out there. There are people who are disbelieving. And the higher the ego of the person you're talking to, the more likely that they're going to denigrate what you've done. That's my, you know, 57 years of being in business or around business people. The higher the disproportionate ego of the person. I mean ego in a bad way. I mean an ego as in, look at me, I need the adulation. And you know, we've got people like that in business. We've got people who do it all about themselves. And unfortunately, there's a lot of them out there. In the CEO ranks, I didn't get along well with some of the CEOs in my community because they wouldn't address the issues that we had with some of the medical device companies. And that's where they get the Howard's outspoken guy. But the more they get into that, the more they elevate themselves, the more they push down where you are, the more they think they've got it covered where you don't. And that's not a universal rule by any means. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to survive a bad event, you have to ignore everyone except those who really matter to you. So when I got indicted, my circle of friends got narrower. I didn't go out and network. I paid attention to my wife. I don't have children, thank goodness, because I didn't want them at school being told that their dad was a felon. You know, all of that's got to get closer and tighter. And then ignore what you don't have to deal with. Focus on what you've done and get through.
So we're going to do some quick fire questions.
Okay.
Now we're going to do the random one from the listener. I sent it to you. I don't know if you saw it or not, but okay. Random question of the week is, would you rather step on a Lego once per day for an entire week or get a paper cut in between your toes?
Yeah, I heard this on your podcast from last week. You're going to ask me that, so I prepared for that. I agree with you. Give me the paper cut all the time. Now, and this is a great business question, actually. I mean, there's a lot of depth to it. If anyone says Lego, I don't think they should be an entrepreneur. Because an entrepreneur, the first thing you have to deal with is get over the pain. I don't care how bad it is. As long as it's done and you're on to your next thing, that's fine. But anytime you have to look at something that's painful, that's going to happen every single day for the next week, that's going to be a problem. So definitely the paper cut. One of my board members said, bad news is not like wine. It does not get better with age. You know, if you got bad news, get it out there, deal with it, be done with it, and move on. It's the same thing with pain. Get the pain done, be done with it, move on.
Okay, good answer. I definitely agree with you there. Okay. Let's see. So you said you're going into pontoons now.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what your hiring process is for pontoons or what you want to do with pontoons by any means, but if you were still at Vascular Solutions and you were hiring someone, a millennial, a young professional, someone coming out of college today, what are the things you like? Like, what are the attributes you like in college students today? And what are the attributes that you think we're really lacking? What are we missing? Right.
So this is a great question, because we had an apprenticeship program at Vascular Solutions where every year we hire between 4 and 8 recent liberal arts graduates to go in and do a 2-year rotational program to learn medical device sales and marketing. So they do a 6 months in marketing communications, 6 months in training, 6 months in sales reps, following a sales rep, maybe 6 months in product management. They'd rotate through this. And so it was essentially an MBA in medical device sales and marketing that you would do while you were getting paid at Vascular Solutions. So it was a great program. We did it over 10 years. So we had over 50 people. We interviewed, you know, a couple of hundred. We probably got resumes from thousands. So that was a good pool to screen from. And then over that 10 years, I could see which ones worked out well, which ones didn't work out so well. What was I hiring for that I shouldn't have been hiring for? What skills did I need to try to find that would work well in this position? Where was that match? So it was a great data set. And oh, by the way, the company that acquired mine, they destroyed that program. They shut it down the first month. So it's not there anymore, right? Great, great job, guys. Anyway, so what I looked for at the end, I wanted to find people who had learned how to learn, which I think is the essence of a liberal arts education. I don't care what the subject is. It could be medieval art history. But if you have the ability to dive into it, to learn it, and then to communicate it, both verbally and in the written form, then I can give you projects that you don't know anything about, and you'll be able to master that, or at least get up to speed. But if you haven't learned how to learn, if you haven't learned how to read something you don't understand and figure it out, and then be able to communicate it in the spoken word and in the written word, then you can't learn medical devices. I mean, we had to take it as a given. No college graduate knows how to sell or market a medical device. No MBA student knows how to do that. I didn't hire any MBA students. And the reason is, they were the worst of the worst. These people thought they knew what they didn't know how to do. And I couldn't convince them to learn it my way because they thought they already knew it their way. And their way wasn't the way we needed to do it. So I'd rather take someone who came straight out of college, who had smarts and drive and ability to learn and communicate and teach them the basics and grow them up, than I wanted someone who thought they knew how to do something that was going to do it their way, not our way. So that's what I was looking for. And that's what people should demonstrate to their bosses or in the interview, because a lot of guys are looking at, or a lot of managers, hiring managers, are looking for that. They want to see that you have the ability and the drive to learn. And you emphasized that in your podcast last week, is that are they willing to invest the time? It's not just the time. You have to have the ability. There is, you know, there is innate ability in this thing. I was looking for someone who had that skill set, that intelligence. But also on top of that, you have to have the habits to make that work. If you're really smart, but you give up after 5 minutes, that doesn't work. But if you're not very smart and you work all day, that still won't work. So you have to have the smarts, which means just innate ability and reasoning ability. You have to have demonstrated that somewhere, as well as the drive that I want this job, I want to do this job. You combine those two things together and then dive into your work, you'll be successful.
Okay. Now, I think you're the legitimately the perfect person to ask this question. A lot of people question, what do you have to give up to be successful? Right. And some people would say you gave up your life maybe for 5 years to be successful. So let's say before the trial, if I ask you this question, what do you have to give up to be successful? And then I ask you now after the 5 year experience, what would you say? Do you have to give things up?
It would be the same answer. So from when I started the company in 97, I gave up being a lawyer, and I had $300 and a doctor's idea, and I had to go raise $1.5 million to get started. Then I raised another $25 million in venture capital, and $50 million in IPO. And 20 years later, I sell it for $1 billion. Okay, so I had to give something up to start that, and then I had to give something up when I got indicted, and then I sold and gave everything up when I got out. The answer is the same. Maybe I would express it differently, but to me, if you're going to make that jump into business, if you're going to make the jump into being an entrepreneur, or even join a company which is going to just put you through the paces, which is any high achievement company is going to make you really work hard and jump, what you're going to have to give up is the certainty of your schedule. For me, as soon as I said I was going to start the company, if someone had a problem, I had to rejuggle everything else in my life to get that done. It's hard to say, but my number one priority had to be the company. And I was single at the time, so I didn't have a wife or any children. And when I got married, I was already a public company CEO, so my wife knew that about me. But if we were on a vacation, we went on our honeymoon to Australia for 2 weeks. I got back and the board complained that I didn't inform them of something that went on. And I said, I was on my honeymoon. And they go, well, yeah, but the company takes precedence. You know, and that's cold, that's bad. But it's also somewhat true, is if you let something go in your business and it becomes a bigger problem later on, you're going to have so much more pain. You got to take that pain right now. You got to take that paper cut right now rather than the Legos later on, because you got to jump on it and get it put out. And so when you're the owner of the business, the buck stops with you. There's no one else to turn to, and the failure is your own. And so it elevates responsibility. If you are a product manager at Medtronic, there's five other product managers on your team. If you go down, someone else will pick up. That's a great job for someone who doesn't want to have that kind of primary responsibility. There are jobs out there where you don't have to sacrifice your life potentially to solve a problem that comes up at that day. Being a CEO, being an entrepreneur is not that job. And if people think about it that way, that's where people get in trouble. They think, I can do this job and have my life and have all this other stuff and do these vacations and do this stuff. The answer is maybe. If everything goes right, you will. But things don't always go right. And when they don't, you're going to have conflict. Because someone's going to think your priority should be here when business says it should be there. And when that hits in the middle, something's got to drop. That's where the problem becomes. For me, I got into it before I had any other real commitments. I purposely did not expand my network while I was running the company. I did not get involved in, say, politics or a lot of social causes while I was the CEO of a public company, because that's a third rail. But I'm not saying you have to do that. What I'm saying is that priority when you're a business person in that situation is the business. So what you give up is the ability to put something else as your first priority.
Okay.
It's also the reason I didn't have kids, is that I was already a CEO, and I didn't think that would be necessarily fair to them to have me getting yanked away for all this stuff. I just didn't know what could happen. And that's a big regret in my life, you know, at this point.
Interesting. Thank you. That's pretty straightforward. We have one last question.
Okay.
What is one life hack young professionals could do this week an actual actionable thing that they could attempt to try every day this week to further their career, have a better chance of not necessarily, I mean, yes, be more successful, but as you know and I know, I believe it's not really about how much money you make to be successful. Right. It's about happiness and finding things that you love. What can people do?
So this is great because I listened to your podcast. I knew this was coming, so I had a week while I'm driving my car to think about this. And as you can tell, I talk quick and I think quick too. This one, no one else is giving you this one. This is one of my own personal favorites. This is one that gets me not liked by some of the millennial people. I will give you this. Practice your speech. Millennials don't realize how much they are judged by the way they talk. Now, I'm not a perfect speaker. My voice is raspy. You've got a better voice than I have. You got the timbre of a real substantive voice. But I'll give you a couple of things that people can practice that will elevate their credibility to people my age. So you're what, 27 or I'm 57, 30 years apart, double the age, whatever, over double the age, a generation removed. You got to realize that if you're young and in business, you're being judged by older people, and older people are different than you are. When you're old, you can speak the way you want to speak, and other people have to conform to that. But right now, if you want to move ahead and get credibility with older people, if you're a young person, you're interviewing, whatever, you need to speak in a way that the old person is going to give you credibility. The number one thing that young people do with their speech that destroys your credibility is what I call high-rise terminals or uptalk. They end a sentence as if it's a question. And if you remember the movie American Pie, there's the woman who talks about this one time at band camp. We had a lot of fun, and it was great. It's called Valley Talk back in the 90s. And it's kind of come into American speech, not European speech, not newscaster speech, but colloquial speech, and now it's into business speech, where people act like they're saying a question when they're making a statement. And I have a hard time explaining it to people who don't see it, but it's if you become aware of it, be careful, because it'll drive you nuts. Because now I listen for it, and it just drives me nuts. I'll give you an example. A question. Are you going to school? Are you going to school? That's a high-rise terminal. You come up. I'm going to school is a statement. It goes down. I'm going to school is making a statement into a question. And it's a way of acting like you're deferential, but to some people like me, it comes off like you're an idiot. And I'm being very blunt, as I always am, because I'm not running a company, and I'm giving you the advice, and people will think this, and they'll never say it. A lot of it's subconscious. And it's not just high-rise terminals. The way you speak is an important determinant of how you are perceived. And in that apprenticeship program, every year I did a class, a one-hour class with those people on speech. And we went over speaking exercises. And go out there on the internet, there's a lot of speaking exercises. Speak and then listen to yourself. Now, I know people listening to this will say, Howard, take your own medicine because you're talking too quick, you're slurring your words. Yeah, I'm done with my business career, okay? I can talk however I want. And when you go out to the bars or whatever, you can talk like a hip-hop artist all you want. But if you're talking in a professional business setting, make sure that you speak clearly, you enunciate, you use eye contact, and your sentences go down and your questions go up. That's something you can practice very quickly. It doesn't require reading a book. And I think it can help the way you're perceived in a business setting.
Sweet. That's perfect. That's exactly what we needed to hear. And I think that honestly, that wraps it up.
All right. Well, I hope so. I've given you more than you need for this.
Well, that podcast was amazing. He was incredible. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening this week. It means the world to us. If you could do us a huge favor and like, give us a review on iTunes, Google, all of those good places. Go to gomahi.us and make sure you vote on a question you'd like to ask our guests next week. A few reminders about Howard. Now, this was a long podcast, so I want to hit home a couple of points quick. Number one, as Howard pointed out, always ask to speak to a lawyer before you talk with prosecutors. Even if you're innocent, you speaking quickly may give them a reason to target you. Number two, Howard mentioned multiple times, one of the most valuable attributes a professional can have is the ability to learn something new. Number three, this week, work on the way you speak. Find videos online to provide guidance. Complete some speaking exercises. These are pretty unique tidbits So really look into them, try them out this week. And most importantly, I would say maybe listen to the podcast a few more times. Howard says a lot of super valuable things that I believe each of us could really apply to our lives and help us become significantly more successful. So once again, like always, thank you for listening to the show. Sorry for a few of the audio problems in the middle, but we hope you loved it as much as we did, and we'll see you next week.